Blog Talk Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Movie Addict Headquarters with your host, Betty Jo Tucker, author of Confessions of a Movie Addict, right here at www.blogtalkradio.com.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore. That's right, Dorothy. This is Movie Addict Headquarters. You don't have to be a movie addict to visit here, but if you are one, it's definitely the place for you. I'm your host, Betty Jo Tucker, and Nikki Starr, my terrific producer, is also here to help with our tribute to one of Hollywood's great actors, Mr. Jack Lemmon, whose son, Chris Lemmon, just happens to be our special guest today. But before introducing Chris, let's see how Nikki's doing. Hi, Nikki. How are you this afternoon?
I'm doing fine, Betty Jo. How are you?
Well, I'm just wonderful because I'm so excited about our special guest today. And Jack Lemmon was one of my favorite actors. I thought he was such a convincing actor and absolutely loved him in so many of his films like Days of Wine and Roses, Mr. Roberts, Some Like It Hot, The Odd Couple, Save the Tiger, The Apartment, Missing, and The China Syndrome, and I haven't even mentioned all of them that I loved him in. I thought he was skilled at doing both comedy and drama equally well, and moviegoers couldn't seem to get enough of him. Nikki, that's why I'm very happy our guest decided to write a book about his father. It's called A Twist of Lemon, A Tribute to My Father, and after reading it, I highly recommend it to our listeners. Chris has created such a touching memoir. It reveals the family man behind Jack Lemmon's stardom, but happily for movie fans like me, Chris also includes fascinating behind-the-scenes stories about his father's remarkable movie career. Well, of course, Chris is here with us now, so it's my great pleasure to introduce him. Welcome to Movie Addict Headquarters, Chris.
Oh, hello, Betty Jo. It's a pleasure to be with you.
We're honored that you could be with us, Chris. There's been a lot of excitement about your appearance. I've received more emails about your appearance than any other guest that we've had on Movie Addict Headquarters. So
I'm very happy to hear that.
And congratulations on your wonderful book.
Thank you so much.
I really mean it when I recommend it to everyone who loved Jack Lemmon and who's interested in the father-son relationship, because it does cover both topics so poignantly. And I know that your father made so many great films. He received 8 Oscar nominations, I believe, and actually won 2. And wasn't it close to 100 films and TV programs that he had on his resume? That's quite amazing. But I can't help wondering if you knew about his acting philosophy and what that was.
Well, absolutely. I think that I explain it a great deal and in great depth in the book, as Kevin mentions as well, Kevin Spacey, who wrote the foreword. And I think it really, Kevin said it very eloquently in the foreword. Before, as far as anybody knows, before any take Jack Lemmon ever did, he said 2 words, and those words were magic time. And
yes.
As Kevin says in the foreword, it was really more than just a simple calling to his muse. It was really a statement of him as a human being. And I think that really, we can all talk about our individual techniques, but those are very, very personal, just like technique in any art form would be. But to imbue his spirit into a character, you see, that's really what the great actors have the ability to do so seamlessly, as did my father. And Jack Lemmon really truly was a magical human being. He was a magical person. Being around him was magical. He was a human leprechaun. And he had that ability to seamlessly fit those wonderful and charming qualities of his into every performance that he ever did. And that's why it was magic time on or off the screen. One of the things that compelled me to want to publish this very personal book was that he was so delightful off screen, and that I knew a person that nobody out there did. They never got to see that side of Jack Lemmon. They saw the wonderful things he was on screen, but that's one of the things that led me to want to publish, so I could let everybody have a little taste of the wonderful things he was off.
Well, I'm so glad you did, and I like your description there of Jack Lemmon being like a leprechaun. Because
he really was, yeah.
Leprechauns,
I mean,
they're magical.
He was so full of beans and so cheeky and fun and just great, great fun to be around. And anything you ever did with him was just enhanced. Yet at the same time, he was really such a gallant human being. You know, wherever he went, he would just raise the bar. And it's really one of the traits I admired most in him and have done my best to try to emulate.
Well, he certainly was a wonderful role model for you. How did he happen to become an actor?
Well, I think it was destiny. I mean, I think he was an actor from the moment he came on the scene. You know, I tell the story about him being born in the elevator of the Newton Wellesley Hospital. He didn't even make it to the delivery room, as happened with my third child.
You're kidding.
No. It's I really do think the stuff of the parent is passed down. I talk about it in the book as the Lemmon legacy, that kind of legacy of bumbling bewilderment that really coined Pop and gave him that everyman moniker. And you know, I have it too, and when the two of us would get together, it would be magnified triple-fold, and it's there it is right on my kids as well. I mean, you know, my kid was born in the middle of a thunderstorm going down I-84. It barely made it to the delivery room, and if you take a look at that same child, he's got that Jack Lemmon grin pasted all over his face, and so, you know, it's just the way he was, and that's, I think, a bit more of an elaboration on your first question. I think that's one of the things that made him so charming in all of these various roles across the demographics and across the emotional spectrum. I mean, you know, he really was Harry Stoner in Save the Tiger. He really was the character in The Out-of-Towners, who, you know, against all odds, finally conquers New York, only to be hijacked to Cuba on the way home, on his jet flight home to Ohio.
What an ending to a movie.
It certainly was, and it was just so typical of Jack Lemmon, but even magnified even more so off-screen than it was on. You know, I speak about, and we'll get into this as we speak a little later on, but these wonderful adventures that we took together. You know, for instance, one of the places we went was up catch-and-release fly fishing up in Alaska. And fly fishing with Jack Lemmon wasn't fly fishing. You know, it was the rest of us fly fishing while Jack Lemmon did Felix Unger on the banks of the stream trying to straighten out his tackle box, or getting bombed by irate eagles and chased by, you know, enraged bears. You know, only Jack Lemmon could, you know.
That's a great part of your book.
it's good fun. I mean, you know, actually, I don't think I ever really saw him catch a trout that didn't at least pull him into the stream first. So.
You're kidding.
No, it really is true. I mean, that wonderful quality, that Lemmon legacy, which I unfortunately have as well, have inherited. I mean, it was him, so.
Well,
was just so much fun to be with.
And that comes through loud and clear in A Twist of Lemon. Why do you think he loved acting so much, Chris?
Well, I think that, you know, again, I mean, I don't want to paint this book as you know, as contrite either. I mean, I really kind of do get down into it. And you know, and there's nothing, look, there's no wire coat hangers anywhere in this book. So people.
Oh, this isn't
that,
Joan Crawford. This isn't a daddy. This is not a daddy dearest.
No, this is not that. But on the other hand, I didn't cop out, I hope. And, you know, we do get into it. And I think that a lot of his love of acting was not just his incredible talent and his ability to realize that what his calling in life really was, but it was also where he felt the safest as a human being. This was a man who had, you know, had difficulty with close emotional commitment. You know, he was the first person, if you got a little too close, to say, "Hello, operator, we got a bad connection," which was one of his favorite lines. And it made for interesting fodder in the father-son relationship. You know, for instance, I mean, I can't tell you how many times he'd never really say anything to me about our relationship, but I'd hear it from everybody else around me, how proud he was or any other of the other aspects of our relationship. And I think that there was that acting allowed him a safety blanket to really invest himself emotionally in something without the fear of becoming too close and in that aspect becoming vulnerable.
So he actually, I don't know, I'm a little bit confused here.
It's
but
interesting,
maybe.
Isn't it? It's really fascinating if you think about it. And that is the depth of what this book is all about. You know, the father-son relationship is a really fascinating thing. And this book was born out of a defense mechanism. My father died of a protracted illness of cancer in 2001, and I'd been through it with my mother before that. I lost both my parents to that insidious disease. Thusly, my close working relationship with the American Cancer Society. But as a defense, really, there was nothing I could do in the final days when he was there but not really there except to sit next to him, hold his hand, and remember the times that we had together, the good and the bad. And that, after he was gone, as an attempt at a catharsis, I started writing those memories down. And as I wrote some down, more would unfold and more would unfold, and I really felt, it was a healing process. The catharsis was happening for me. I also wanted to write them down for my kids so they could know this side of that man when they got older, too. I remember my daughter once coming to me with big tears. We call it big tears when they really cry. And she said, you know, I feel that the world knows my grandfather better than I do. And, boy, that really struck me. And those were the reasons I originally started writing this very personal memoir slash biography, autobiography. But then I realized I was kind of really beginning to investigate something that wasn't investigated very often, and that was the mysterious father-son relationship, the loving yet guarded, one of the most important relationships a man can ever have. And
right.
I think, you know, that in life, even in relationships that aren't functional, and certainly in the ones that are, that the son seeks approval from the father. And in turn, there's a quiet hand on that son's shoulder, reassuring them. And when the father goes, that hand is gone too. You know, that famous old quote, a man doesn't become a man until he loses his father. And the accompanying aloneness, at least for me, was overwhelming. And that was the birth, that was the reason. You've got 11 on the phone, incidentally. We do a half hour on hello, so just shut me up if I rattle on too
much. Well, I will, or Nikki will, but
okay,
this is so interesting you're revealing.
Finally, the final thing that actually said, you know what, I'm going to go ahead and publish this very personal account, was that he really was so beloved. I mean, people really did adore Jack Lemmon. He really did please most of the people most of the time. He really was that everyman. And these memories in this book that, are so personal and run the emotional spectrum from melancholy to hopefully knee-slappingly funny, because he was, and that's what I tried to be, I just felt compelled to share them with all those people that do love him. And so that was the final the final straw, that said, yes, I think I want to go ahead. And
well, I think you've done a wonderful job on this, Chris, and
that
we have such a better understanding of Jack Lemmon, both as an actor and as a father by reading this book. And so what you're telling us is that he loved acting because he could express his emotions
without getting too close. Yes,
without getting too close.
It makes him vulnerable. If it's done on a one-to-one basis in real life, you become vulnerable when you open yourself up to another person.
Well, did he prefer comedy or drama? Did you know?
I think the whole point of his statement as an artist, as an actor, was that he preferred both. That was something that he really struggled against early in his career, was being pigeonholed as a comedic actor. And that's why he was turning work down to get the right vehicle, which probably ended up being Days of Wine and Roses, which was the real, even though The Apartment Boy, there was some magnificent depth to that as well, though it would be deemed a comedic performance, a comedy.
Days of Wine and Roses is my favorite Lemmon performance,
and it
haunts me.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just mentioning that it still haunts me. It was so brilliant. he definitely became the character.
Well, sure he did.
It
was a wonderful beginning to his relationship with Blake Edwards as well. They did a number of films together, and Blake is just a equally brilliant artist himself in his own way. But that was the one I think that broke him through, and it was as we call it, the hot kiss at the end of the wet fist for all those people out there who wanted to pigeonhole Jack Lemmon as a comedic actor.
Right, because he was a wonderful dramatic actor too. Yes, why do you think he was so popular with everyone? Do you know that I saw so many Jack Lemmon films and looked forward to them so much and loved them so much, I almost thought of him as part of my family. And
well,
I wonder if that's exactly it.
It really was, as I said, it was that everyman quality. He really was such a nebbish in real life, he did two things really brilliantly. One of them was the ability to take those parts of himself that imbued that aspect and others into his characters and seamlessly fit them in there, and then without ever letting The Wire show, be able to fill in the gaps with technique. And that's, let's face it, I mean, that's what really true great acting is all about. The other thing that he did, maybe, and this is what Cliff Robertson in his little few pages in the book says so brilliantly. Cliff was the original person to play that character in Days of Wine and Roses. You know that, as a television.
He was set to play the part that your dad finally took in Days of Wine and Roses.
No, The Days of Wine and Roses was originally a teleplay, and Cliff played that character.
Oh, yes, right.
Yeah, yeah. But so, as Cliff said it so well, and it really is true, and I tell a number of stories about it in the book, he had the ability to do something which, in my opinion, is equally as important as the actual work of acting, which is to pick which parts and pick which projects to be in. And his instincts were phenomenal, as good as any or maybe even better than any out there at picking the right projects. One of the stories I tell that points that out, and having the right instincts for them as well, that I tell in the book that points that out, is that he was originally offered a project that he fell in love with and said, boy, I really want to be a part of this project, I want to produce this project, but I don't feel I'm right to play this part. As a matter of fact, I know who is. And he approached that actor. The actor said yes, and boy, was Pop right, because the following year, God bless his soul, Paul Newman was nominated for an Academy Award for his performance in Cool Hand Luke.
Cool Hand Luke.
Pop was originally offered that part, said, I think Paul Newman's better at this part, but I want to produce it because I think this is going to be one hell of a film. Now, talk about instincts. And
oh, he had great instincts.
Yes, that's the whole point. Talk about being selfless enough to understand what is going to make the best possible movie, as averse to saying, wow, what a role. And,
right.
And now, of course, there was the other side of the coin as well. He didn't make many mistakes. I can only really remember two, and I write about both, and one of them is one of my favorite stories. It was a film that he starred in that just wasn't very good, and he wasn't all that great in it either, and I think he knew it. So he went to his buddy Walter Matthau and said, Waltz, will you come to the screening with me and be my security blanket while I watch this thing? And this kind of proves my point that choosing the right project, because if you choose the wrong one, you're stuck with it forever. And they went and they saw the screening, and sure enough, the thing was a barker. And afterwards, everybody was filing out very quietly, and as anybody who's involved in the business knows, quietly is never good at the end of a screening. And finally, very nervously, Pop turned to Walter and said, so what did you think? Walter thought about it a second and turned to him and said, get out of it.
Well, that was good advice, Walter.
Well, it's just so Walter. You know, in just four words, he can capitalize such a complicated thing and get a good laugh at it.
Well, your father and Walter Matthau made about 10 movies together.
Something like that.
And they were such good friends. Why do you think they became such good friends?
Well, I think it was a match made in heaven on screen. It was just one of those things that. Yeah, when you see a great performer, when you see a great actor, you can sit and talk and flap your gums all day long. But what it really boils down to is something completely unexplainable at the end of the day, which I call the it factor. They've just got it. And that's, I think, true of comedy teams and comedy duos as well, like Hope and Crosby, like Laurel and Hardy, like Abbott and Costello and like Matthew Alan Lemon. They just had it.
They did. They definitely had the
and
it factor.
Off-screen, quite honestly, and in the number of stories that Walter's included in the book, I hint at this too without trying to – I tried to write the whole book without hitting any nails on the head. You know, it's, who wants to read a book where all the nails are being hit on the head? But I think that Waltz really was the big brother that Pop never had and always wanted. You know, Pop was an only child. He always wanted a brother. But, boy, after what God bless gorgeous Gigi, she called herself Gorgeous Grandma, Gigi for short, his mother, she said, I'm never doing it again after she had Pop. Never again. You know, when Pop asked her for a brother. And I think Waltz was that brother. And I'll tell you, I think if Waltz had learned to play golf, Pop probably would have married him.
You would have married him. I think you're probably right. Well, you worked with your father on three films, Dad, That's Life, and Airport 77.
That's right.
Is that?
Yeah, and actually, you know, That's Life was a Blake film as well.
Yes, and what was it like to work with him on a film?
It was just, you know, it was joyful. There was, again, you know, the whole thing is just not to let the work show. You know, you do, and of course all of that comes from properly preparing for the work as well, but and Pop was as good as any at prepping. And also, That's Life was a wonderfully unique experience we actually ad-libbed the entire movie. There was no script for that.
Really?
Part. Yeah, yeah. We got together in rehearsal, ad-lib our scenes, and then kind of lock in and go and do them. So it was really a very unique experience in that aspect. But you never saw the work with Pop. It was, again, it was the work was all there, of course, but it was effortless. And, of course, that's what any actor shoots for. You know, you look at a beautiful, like a Ferrari, and you're not looking at all that, the incredible engine, the incredible brakes and suspension. And this, you're looking at that beautiful body. You know that stuff's underneath, but you're still looking at the beautiful body, and that's what giving performances, great performances in acting, I think should be like. You never show the work. The work
right. Never let the wheels show.
Right, exactly. But the work's all been done because that's why the performance is there.
Right. As I mentioned before, Chris, I just love the way you included so many movie insider stories about your dad because, of course, I am a movie addict. And what do you think is the funniest one that you included in your book? I have two of my favorites, but
boy, there's a ton of them. And again, that was when I went to my dear wife, and you know, as a few minutes ago when we were talking about the why of my publishing this book, you know, and I gave her all of these reasons, some light, some heavy, and this and that, and she, you know, in her wonderful, inimitable wisdom, kind of shook her head and said, and then she turned to me and said, make it funny, because that's what Pop was. He was just darn funny. I think Vernalisi's husband story.
Yes, that's one of my favorites.
Yeah,
when, right.
You know, Vernalisi's husband chasing him through the Paramount lot, you know, maybe one of my favorites. I don't know if I should paraphrase it now, but just very quickly, that was on How to Murder Your Wife. And
right.
A nasty fall and really pulled some muscles in his back and this and that. And he was storming, you know, just wanted to go and lay down. So he stormed through the studio, and they had all these little cottage dressing rooms that were all alike. And Vernalisi's husband was they're from Italy. I mean, this guy's a full-blown Italian, barely speaks any English, and he was extremely jealous of the fact that Vernie was playing this sexy character who's being catcalled by people. And he showed up, you know, flew cross-country crossed the pond because of his jealousy and found her in a scene where the construction guys are catcalling her, had an absolute tantrum. She finally calmed him down, and she's in the dressing room without a stitch of clothing on, and Pop mistook her room for his and came bursting in. Well, that's all this guy needed to see. It was all over, and it literally turned into a Keystone Cops movie with, you know, Pop furtively running through the alleys of Paramount Studios with this irate 6'5" Italian running after him. With Vernalisi, with not a stitch of clothing except a bathrobe, clung around her, chasing after him, with all the grips and the crew and the producers chasing after them, and finally the director afterwards screaming, cut, cut.
It's like a movie itself.
That was
one of my
favorites. Yeah.
I like the George Cukor story, too, on the very first movie that
yeah.
that your dad made, and George Cukor really taught him a lesson about acting, didn't
absolutely.
He?
Absolutely. Well, you know, Pop is a contained tornado. I mean, you know, take a look at like Ensign Pulver and some Mr. Roberts. You know, I mean, this is the kind of energy, or of course, you know, God bless Daphne in Some Like It Hot. This is the kind of energy this man had. And Cukor was marvelous because, you know, they were doing, I believe, what was it, It's a Wonderful Life or something like that. It was one of his first films, and Pop's on the set, of course, being a contained tornado, and Cukor with that marvelous kind of underbite lisp that he had was like, oh, Jack, that's a lovely performance, dear, but just could you give me a little bit less? Pop would say, okay, a little bit less, okay, all right, here we go. And he comes in and starts chewing up the furniture again. And Cukor again is just lovely, Jack. Cut a little bit less, Jack. And finally, you know, Pop turns to him and says, Jesus Christ, George, if I give you any less, I won't be acting. To which Cukor turned to him and said, exactly.
I think that's just a classic. Oh, Chris, I wonder, we've extended the show for 15 minutes and so that we can take some calls. And I notice we have a call now. Would you be willing to take it?
Sure, of course.
Okay, hold on. Area code 828, thank you for holding. This is Movie Addict Headquarters, and we have Chris Lemon as a guest. Who's calling, please?
Hi, this is Wild Wagon.
Well, hi, Wild Wagon. Thank you for calling. Do you have a question or a comment for Chris Lemon?
Yeah, I have a question for Chris. I want to know how it was growing up with a famous dad in the movie industry.
Well, it's interesting. I actually ended up, because that was the one question I was asked more than any other question in my entire life, was what's it like to be Jack Lemmon's son? And I finally ended up having to write a chapter in this book in order to give the proper answer for it, because it covered such a large area of emotional investment. So the best answer I can say to everybody out there listening is, go buy the book and the Jack Lemmon's son chapter, and that question will be answered as thoroughly and completely as I possibly can.
Well, that's a good answer.
Not to completely cop out on you, Wild, but okay. As a quick sidebar, yes, it was a little difficult in the aspect that as a child you are identified as an object, not as a person. In my case, Jack Lemmon's son and not Chris Lemmon. But let me just say this, that on the other side of the coin, he was, again, so magical, so wonderful, such a great guy, and not just my father, but my very best friend. So there's the two sides to that coin. And also, thank you for saying that, because one of the things I really, when I made the decision to publish this book, the one thing I didn't want to do was start saying, oh, poor me. You never saw my father do it once in any of the performances he ever gave. And, boy, there were some characters like CeCe Baxter in The Apartment who could have gotten very self-indulgent and self-piteous, and you never saw him do it, and you never saw him do it in real life, not even until the day he died. His only thought was for us, his family. And the last thing I wanted to do was write a book where I started going, oh, poor me, and, you know, do another one of these, I'm sorry, you know, if I'm being a little blanketing, but one of these stars kids, you know, cry into the cup of tea. You know what? I don't think anybody wanted to hear that about Jack Lemmon, and I don't want to publish that when our sons and daughters are overseas giving their lives for our country. The last thing I think they need to hear is a stars kid crying into his cup of tea. So thank you for that question.
That is a great answer, and that was a wonderful question, Wild Wagon. Thanks so much for calling in.
No problem. Thank you, guys.
Bye. Well, everyone wanted to know that, so I'm glad Wild Wagon asked that question. And along the same lines, you've really been involved in showbiz, too, Chris. I know that you've had about 37 movies and television programs that you've been associated with, and now you have your own production company, Stone Manor Productions, which, by the way, if people want to know more about the book or to purchase it, if they decide not to go to Amazon.com, they can go to Stone, S-T-O-N-E, Manor, M-A-N-O-R, productions.com and find out more about it. But
yeah,
why don't you tell us a little bit about what you've got on
sure.
on your plate now?
Yeah, just, I went ahead and put, because I get asked that question so often. Sure, you can go to Barnes, any of the bookstores or those and find it, and also at Amazon. So I just put a link on the literary page on our website, so that'll link you over to Amazon. Actually, I got to change it because I think that links you to the hardcover. Ooh, thanks for reminding me of that, Betty Jo.
Right, but tell us what you've got going.
Well, you can also see all the stuff I got going. Actually, the most exciting project I have right now is a film that my wife and I wrote together called Publicity Stunt. And it's very near and dear to my heart because the original concept, though it's changed a great deal, it shows you how long these damn things take to get going, was something that my father and I originally started producing together, and that he loved the idea of it. It kind of harkens back to those kind of films that, you know, the Some Like It Hots and Mad Mad World, and in this case, actually, Big Fat Greek Wedding is really a big role model for this film. Actually, Joel Zwick, who's the fellow who directed Big Fat Greek Wedding, is attached as our director. So
great.
We're just, you know, going through the woes of funding. Any independent filmmaker will tell you it's just. You know, you spend most of your time trying to raise the money, and then every once in a while you get lucky enough to be an artist. But, you know, the funding has been interesting, to say the least, and hopefully we'll be able to
I can't wait to see it because I can't believe the people lined up to be in it. Cliff
Robertson.
Well,
you know, we wanted to put all these wonderful old-time actors, and they're not getting any younger, so we really are hoping that it's going to... You know, Harvey Korman had a large part in this film. He had a wonderful scene that I wanted him and Tim. And Harvey's an old friend, you know, as are most of the cast. I had a great scene where he and Tim Conway played these two old used car salesmen that frustrate the intention of the two heroes in the story. And now Harvey's not with us anymore. God bless his soul. One of the greatest guys on the face of the earth. But.
And he was just terrific, and my favorite was Blazing Saddles. But you've got Charles Durning,
well, you know
Dom
DeLuise. We got Dom DeLuise.
Henry, Peter Falk.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
I'm keeping my fingers crossed
going,
on that.
Keep going. It's kind of the inside joke of the film, is every corner you turn, it's you know, one of these great, starker actors poking fun at their own persona.
Sounds great.
Yeah,
Chris, I'm going to ask Nikki if there's if there are any questions or comments in the chat room that she'd like to share with us. Nikki?
Well, you know how I always ask, what is your favorite movie?
Yes.
And we have from Some Like It Hot to Grumpy Old Men to Hamlet. Everybody just loves everything.
Wow.
Yeah.
Those
That's
are
the first
great.
Time I heard that one,
mm-hmm.
yeah. It's, you know, Grumpy Old Men was marvelous because it introduced Pop and Walter to a whole new generation, and it was also a real catharsis for their career. I shouldn't say catharsis, a real rejuvenation to their career, a rebirth, a renaissance for their career.
Right.
I'm fishing for the right description, but anyways, it was nice because they hadn't worked for a while. And Grumpy Old Men busted open, the Math Al Lemon team again after I think 8-10 years.
And it was hilarious.
It really was. It was one of those wonderful, kind of heartwarming. It just had all the right ingredients. And Don Rye, who directed the original, really put his finger on it just right. It was a lovely couple of films for them.
Well, what is your favorite, Chris? What is your favorite?
Almost impossible to answer that question, again, for the very reason that we started out our little interview with, because he was so, you know, he was able to do so many different types of performances, from dramatic to broad comedy and everything in between. One of my very favorites, and you know, my wife slaps me across the head every time I say it, but I can't help it because it is, was The Great Race.
That was so funny.
And probably because I had such a great time as a kid. You know, I would go on the set and I'd fence with Tony Curtis, who was the great Leslie, and I'd ride around on the Fate-mobile with my father and Peter Falk, and they'd have golf carts. Blake had these different golf carts that were dressed up exactly like the cars they drove in the film, and they'd all race to lunch together, and, you know, Blake, boy, I'll tell you, this man knows how to run a fun set. He's so full of beans and so much fun himself anyway.
And of course, he and Julie Andrews and the whole Edwards Andrews clan are like a second family to us. But anyways, The Great Race. But I really think that of if you have to pin me down, I think Missing, for a number of different reasons, was
Missing.
One of the most important to me. Missing, yes.
And he was nominated for an Oscar for Missing.
Oh, indeed he was, as was the film, and Costa Gavras, one of the great directors of all times, and also one of the more important films, the message of the film. But also for a very personal reason, because I found out, and I only found out after he died from my wife, who hadn't told me before because she thought I knew, which harkens back to the whole thing we were talking about earlier, the mysterious father-son relationship. He'll talk to everybody else, but he won't say it to you. And I think that's true of a lot of father-son relationships. I only found out after the fact that, you know, of course, the story is about the true life story of Charles Horman, who lost his son. His son was murdered by a South American regime with the full knowledge of the American government, who disavowed that knowledge. That's
tragic.
Tragic story. And I found out that in order to reach those notes, Pop used me as the role model, as the son. I only found out after he passed away, and it was not an easy moment. But for that reason, Missing, I would have to, if I have to pick one, that's it.
Well, that would be a special movie for you. And I understand, going back to The Great Race, that there was some talk about doing a sequel and you starring in it.
Yeah, doggone it. It was Blake came up to us when we were doing That's Life one day and said, you know, I've got a great idea. And why don't we do The Great Race 2? Of course, they go from Paris back to New York. And we got the Prince of Potsdorf and Professor Fate. Pop played both roles. Let's do Professor Fate has a son, who, of course, is the exact opposite of him. And then the Prince of Potsdorf has twin sons. So now you can't tell anybody apart anywhere. You got five people playing characters that look like each other and pretending to be each other. And, you know, if there was anybody, Blake, with his Pink Panther and with all the marvelous, you know, marvelous, not slapstick, but, you know what I'm saying, that type of film, and The Great Race being one of the gems in the crown of that type of filmmaking. Boy, could he have done it. And
that would have been great. I would have been the first one lining up for that one.
Yeah, he couldn't wrest the rights away from Columbia Studios, unfortunately.
Oh, bummer.
Yes, exactly.
Well,
if you think it's a bummer, boy, you should have seen what I thought.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
That would have been a wonderful experience.
I think we have to mention your father's performance in Some Like It Hot.
Say again, in Some Like It Hot?
Yes.
Oh, well, sure. I mean, AFI thinks it's the greatest comedy of all times, I ain't going to argue with him.
And his portrayal of Jerry and Daphne has been named the 33rd greatest performance, I believe, of all time, too, by one of the magazines. I'm not sure of that, but I know it's on everybody's list of great performances.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it is truly one of the great classics of all times. And one of the great performances, and some of the greats. There was actually a few stories I couldn't fit in the book or I'd either forgotten or just didn't have a reason to structurally to put in. But one of my favorites is the one with Marilyn Monroe, where Marilyn had the famous story where she did 32 takes with Billy Wilder on Hi, I'm Honey. She just couldn't get it. It was one of those days. You know, Marilyn was what Marilyn was. She was an absolute genius and better at what she did than anyone. That's why she was what she was and will always be an icon. But Marilyn would also get a little goofy sometimes and go up. And 32 takes on Hi, I'm Honey. And it happened the day before Pop was supposed to do that big, long scene where she jumps into the bunk with him.
Yes.
And if you notice, Billy shot that scene in one. That almost that whole scene, you'll never see a cut. And which is, of course, the earmark of great directing and great acting, and every actor loves directors who do that, who will let them go 3, 4, 5, 6 pages without cutting. And that was one of those scenes, and Pop knew, oh, well, if she went up on Hi, I'm Honey, she's going to be all over the place on this, so what I'm going to do is, this is Lemon, you know, this is the scheming Lemon, I'm not going to give him everything I got for the first 10, 15 takes. We'll let her go up, and when it looks like she's going to get one, boom, I'm going to come in there and I'm going to give it everything. You know what? She got it on the first take. Billy Wilder said, cut, print, that's it, moving on. And my old man is left going, wait, Billy, hold on a second. And that's it. So there you go. True story.
I love it. I love it. And that last scene with Joey Brown and your dad, and when Joey Brown finds out that Daphne is a man, and one of my favorite lines in the movie, oh, well, nobody's perfect.
Nobody's perfect. I put it in Publicity Stunt as an inside joke.
Great.
I play the lead in Publicity Stunt.
Oh, I can't wait to.
And there's a similar situation in Publicity Stunt to that that Joel and I obviously purposely crafted, and we give a marvelous, Steve Buscemi's available. We want him to play that particular part. He gets
Well, I hope when you get finished with Publicity Stunt, which I know you will, and I know you'll get the funding, that you'll come back on the show and we can talk about that that movie.
Well, if anybody out there wants to make a really funny film, give me a call.
and they can contact you through Stone Manor Productions.
Absolutely. That'll be a first.
Right. Well, I usually ask this question of everyone on the show. What's the most important thing you want people to know about you and your work, Chris?
Well, I mean, in that case, I'll say in pertaining to this book, because
yes,
this book has been, I'm really very, very proud of it, and it's been emotionally one of the most rewarding things I've ever done, not just as a person, but as an artist. And a lot of that comes from the reaction that I've gotten to it. It's been, you know, we didn't get one bad review. It's been now 2 years in hardback, and now it's here it is born again internationally in paperback. First of all, let me sidebar really quickly and say hats off also to Algonquin Books, who did the hardcover, and to Applause, who are doing such a terrific job with this soft cover. Boy, they really have done a great job for having the guts to publish a loving tribute and not a coat hanger-esque story. Lord knows it is not easy to do in this marketplace.
Well,
but
congratulations to them, too.
And
I better not hear about anybody giving it a bad review.
You know what? We haven't gotten one. And also, people have come up to me, you know, as I've toured it all across the country and all over the world, you know, and the stories they tell me that, you know, that this book has changed their lives, that it's, you know, rescued a relationship with an estranged loved one and all sorts of other ones. You know, Pop once said to me, he said, if you can touch just one person, you've done your job. And every time I hear that, it's, you know, I feel that I really was, you know, it was a good thing that I went ahead and decided to finally publish this.
It was a very good thing.
The one thing I would say, and really kind of the overlying message of all of this is, you know, go to those people that you love and go every day and tell them that you love them and hug them, because they might not be here tomorrow, and you don't know what you've got until it's gone.
That is a very important message for us all, and I'm so sorry to see our time is up, Chris. You've really made the time fly by for us. Thanks so much for being such a generous and great guest. I know Nikki joins me in wishing you success with A Twist of Lemon, as well as with all your upcoming projects, especially Publicity Stunt. Hope you come back and visit us again soon.
Well, this
yes,
has been a lovely
you.
Interview, Betty Jo. Thank you so much for having me.
It was our pleasure. This is Betty Jo Tucker giving a big shout-out to the folks at Blog Talk Radio for all their help in connection with this show. Special thanks, of course, to Nikki Starr for everything she does to make Movie Addict Headquarters happen, and to Chris Lemon again for visiting us today. Thanks also to everyone who listened live or to the archives or called in, and I appreciate Wild Wagon calling in with that great question or participated in the chat. We really appreciate it. And remember, dear listeners, be sure to protect yourselves from identity theft, which is the fastest growing crime in America, by going to www.lifelock.com, that's LIFELOCK, and finding out about the important services offered there. You'll receive a 10% discount when you sign up for these services if you use our special code, REALTALK, REELTALK, and it's all one word. Please come back next time for another lively discussion about movies. In the meantime, check out our film reviews at realtalkreviews.com. That's R-E-E-L, realtalkreviews.com. And you'll also find my review of A Twist of Lemon on that site. Now, well, it is a honey of a book. Now, here's the very talented A.J. Daniels to close the show with a song dedicated to all our loyal Blog Talk Radio listeners.
to me and be true.